Welcome to a new episode of What Exactly Am I Watching Here? A proud member of the Overthink Podcast Network. I'm your host, for now, Jason Helms. And I'm no longer a lonely soul, as I am joined by my good bud, Dominic Lang. Say hi, Dom.
Jason, good to be here, and it's good to be on the path with you.
We'll walk it together, wherever it may lead.
Indeed.
Through the dark of futures past, the magician longs to see one chance out between two worlds, fire. Walk with me. I'll catch you with my death bag. You may think I've gone insane, but I promise I will podcast again. Before we begin, a quick introduction to the show. What Exactly Am I Watching Here is a podcast that features an expert, myself, and a novice.
Myself.
Watching one of the great shows of television history. As Agent Cooper told Audrey, the foundation of any lasting relationship is friendship, and the foundation of any lasting friendship is television. For now, our show is the cult favorite Twin Peaks. We're diving into season two of the show today, but we encourage you to check out the show for yourself, available on Amazon Prime and Netflix, and listen to our previous episodes. Come up with some of your own theories about this strange and wondrous place called Twin Peaks. So without further ado, let's jump into season two, episodes 5 through 9.
Yes,
Dom,
sir.
Where are we at?
So season two, a few episodes in, we are still working through what feels initially season one. It felt like our central mystery of who killed Laura Palmer. But as we are progressing through season two, it's feeling less and less our driving narrative. We are meeting kind of a wider net of characters now. This includes Harold Smith, an extremely reclusive horticulturist who is forming as a connection or slash relationship with Donna Hayward. We have Mr. Tojimura, who has come from Japan with extreme interest in the Great Northern Hotel. We also have several characters from season one who are in, shall we say, uncertain states. Nadine, who has seemingly regressed to her high school state. We have Leo, who is a vegetable at this point, and Catherine Martell, who is missing still after the mill fire. So we still have holdover mysteries from season one that have not been addressed.
And we'll address some of those today. A good chunk of them.
Yeah.
And during today's episode, we will finally solve the murder of Laura Palmer.
Ooh.
So get excited for that.
There we go.
One thing I wanted to say, I actually watched episode 10 with my wife, Megan.
What?
Yep. I went one more. And let me tell you why. Because I sat down with her last night and we were going to watch a movie. I said, you know, what movie do you watch? You want to watch? And she said, I really just want to watch Twin Peaks. I was like, wait, why? What's going on? She said, well, I know you don't want to get too far ahead because you're doing the podcast and everything, but I've just come to love the town and I just love the people there and I want to see what's going on with them. And it's just a place I want to visit. That was such the perfect response.
Isn't that the sweetest? My goodness.
So she gets it. It works.
Yeah, she absolutely gets it. Jason, I know we're going to dig into each individual episode, but I am on board, man. I'm in. Like, these episodes were so fantastic and so rich. When you said episode 9 was a good kind of like a fitting just rhythmic end or rhythmic kind of period and everything, I couldn't agree more. But the run up to episode 9, still just everything coming together and culminating and connections being made and so much to dig into. So I'll let you take it away, but I am pumped to be talking about Twin Peaks tonight.
Sweet. And because of that, we may spend a little bit more time on episode 9 than some of the other episodes. So if we feel like we're going quickly, that's probably why.
Yep.
Without further ado, let's break down some episodes. Season 2, episode 5, The Orchid's Curse, in which Cooper and Truman stage a raid on One-Eyed Jack's. Leland's court hearing begins. Donna and Madeline plot to steal Laura's secret diary from Harold Smith. Ben gets a business proposition from the mysterious Mr. Tojimura. Shelley and Bobby reignite their relationship, even as the catatonic Leo lives under the same roof.
So the raid on One-Eyed Jack's feels, for me, like the conclusion to one of the bigger hanging threads from season one. Cooper and Truman are finally putting the pieces together. And so this feels like, okay, that piece is now concluding and now coming into new business of season two, where Audrey is a far more enlightened, aware person. And so this feels like a clear distinction between those for me.
Yeah. And it is, you're right. It's a melodramatic kind of moment. The ending of it where Hawk axes the guy in the back.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, that's pretty awesome. It's just over the top. It's it's not believable at all, but we're not interested in that world. You know, we're interested in the world of Twin Peaks.
Yeah. Yeah, that very much felt like a almost kind of like the end of a scene in a play.
Yeah.
Just like, all right, we're closing out on this area. Like, it served its purpose and we're moving on.
Yep. Or a cutscene in a video game. Yeah, we finished the One-Eyed Jax level.
Yeah. And now, moving on to a new level.
Yeah.
I'm trying, at this point, I'm trying to suss out the dynamic and context of Donna Hayward and Harold Smith's relationship. What interested me most about Harold Smith is the living novel concept.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, I had a hard time grasping it, but I was also really curious about it, of like, in an ideal scenario, does he listen to someone's story and then, like, is he tapped into something that, like, he gets just a little bit from that person, but he's able to glean so much more?
Yeah. And he is writing it down. So it's, the novel is being written in some sense, but he was also very insistent that the real novel is him. You know, writing is just kind of part of his method.
Yeah.
But the real novel is him living this thing.
Got it. Yeah.
It reminds me actually of a Borges short story called The Secret Miracle, in which there's this guy standing in front of the firing squad, and his one regret is that he has never been able to finish his novel. He had this amazing novel in mind, and he doesn't believe in God. But at that moment he prays, he said, "God, get me out of this because I just need to write my novel. It's going to be the most important work of art ever, and I devote it entirely to you." And then the gun fires, and he doesn't die. And he's standing there staring, and time is frozen. And he realizes he's been granted this secret miracle. And so he writes the entire novel while bound to the pole, waiting for the bullet to hit him. And he writes the entire thing, and of course, as soon as he gets to the last page, time comes back, and he's killed. A miracle that only he knew about.
Oh my goodness.
That's cool, because from the outside, you can envision that miracle happening to anyone else at any point.
It reminds me of, and maybe there's connective thread here, but I saw it as a Twilight Zone episode, but an occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge.
Oh, totally.
And I forget the circumstances of why this person is being hung, but he's condemned to die. And he's a very sorrowful man. And when he's dropped from the bridge to hang, the rope snaps. And he falls into the river and he escapes and he goes on this journey and finds this measure of peace. And right at the moment of peace, you flash back to the bridge and you realize all that happened in the flash, all that happened in the distance between the bridge and him falling. The rope actually holds and he dies. But in that space, there is that, wow, there's that miracle.
Yeah, and that's also a famous short story, occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge. I would assume that Borges was influenced by it. I'm reflecting now on the way that both resonate with the end of episode 9, which we'll get to in a moment, which is really about, you know, where does evil come from, and do we need to know? Does it help us at all if we can get that answer? And the reason they resonate for me is, do people get these kind of last reprieves? Is there meaning in death? We see someone sacrifice themselves for someone else, and we want to see that death as meaningful. But for the person doing it, it has to be over so quickly, I would imagine, that they don't get that meaning.
Mm.
But of course, we can't know. Until you sacrifice yourself for someone else, until you die, you don't get to experience that and know what it is, which returns to the end of episode 9, and doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Anything else from episode 5?
No, not for me, man.
Do you want to talk about the budding relationship between Donna and Harold?
only in the sense of at this episode, I'm still unclear as to Donna's motivation. It feels in part like a strike back against James. It feels like she's on her own kind of quest, which I'm kind of okay with, in the sense of like giving Donna something to do, a little more agency. And so I'm really trying. I'm also frustrated, truth be told, yeah, of like Donna and James and Madeline still not talking to the police. Just like, if the police were an untrustworthy force in this story, I'd get it. But you have Sheriff Truman, you have Cooper, you have people who have proven to be nothing but upstanding, truth-seeking people. And the fact that you remain duplicitous, like, it speaks to your core nature. And like Twin Peaks is a show that deals very much with the core natures of people and their duplicity and their propensity to say one thing and purport an image, but then be something in someone else entirely. And this does not end well for Donna. There's tension that exists throughout their relationship and their lives for what I believe is this very reason.
Well, I think the other reason they don't go to the police is that they're high schoolers. Not that, you know, high schoolers are notoriously suspicious of police, but they're play acting. They're pretending to be adults, and they don't have the rules yet, and they're trying to figure that out. So one of the things you said is, you know, this is who they really are. It shows something about their core nature. I think high school, and I think this is part of what David Lynch is doing with Twin Peaks, high school is this moment when you can be a lot of things, and just before things really start to coalesce. And in that hazy kind of dream space, you find out who you are, but you don't know it yet. It's not there. Retroactively, you'll look back in 20 years and you'll be able to say, oh, yeah, that's why I did that in high school, because that's who I was all along.
Yeah.
But it's only given that 20 years you can do it. And I say that thinking about Twin Peaks: The Return, when we get to see some of the characters again from the original Twin Peaks, and you can see where they went, and you can see the trajectory all the way back here.
Gotcha.
Did Lynch know it? Did the characters know it? Did I know it when I was in high school? The other thing that I'm reflecting on is the first time I watched this, I was in college, and I remember James being a much bigger part of this story. And I think it's because I identified more with him. Okay. He was, to me, the protagonist. He was male. He was my age.
Yeah.
He looked like James Dean. It was the protagonist role. And on rewatching it, he's a pretty minor character.
Oh, yeah. Like him, Bobby, like the high school scene initially given a lot of rope in the early episodes has really like sort of like One Eyed Jacks has kind of played itself out, I would say.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. So episode 6, Demons. Shelley and Bobby host a welcome home party for Leo, Cooper's boss. Gordon Cole warns Cooper of threats from Wyndham Earl. Josie strikes a deal with Ben. The one-armed man reveals some information about Bob. And Leland returns to work.
Jason, I didn't hear that last episode summary. You're going to have to talk a little louder.
And, of course, you know the actor playing Gordon Cole?
The one, the only, Mr. David Lynch.
How good is that? And now the idea that Coop is doing a David Lynch imitation the entire time. Yeah. That's what Kyle MacLachlan is doing to Channel Agent Cooper. Makes sense. They're mirrors.
It absolutely makes sense. And as episode 6, as much as it is a delight for me to see Lynch on screen and Gordon Cole, who, you know, whom I've heard much about, I just, all cards on the table, I cannot care less about Shelley and Bobby and Leo at this point. They seem off on their own little quasi-comic, quasi-tragic. It seems like a bad riff on The Gift of the Magi. I'm ready for that to be done. Like I appreciated the fact that we got to meet the judge in the trial. And yeah, at this point, Shelley and Bobby, I have no time for you. I'm far more interested in other characters.
Yep. On this episode, I feel like in some ways is a little bit of stalling. It's a little bit of setup for the next episode, which is where we really are going to learn who killed Laura Palmer.
Yeah.
Now, whether or not we accept that is another thing. I'd love to talk to you about that. Anything else about episode six, though? Because I didn't think there was a ton there, even though many things happened.
Yeah. Just again, like a mention of Wyndham Earle, whom we've not met yet, who looms over specifically Agent Cooper, and him and Cole discuss. I'm not sure if this is the first time that the incident in Pittsburgh is discussed in such detail.
Right.
And
we're building on it, certainly. It's not the first time Pittsburgh's been mentioned, but
right, right. But Cole brings it up again quite emphatically, as most everything Cole says. But I think the voiceover from Log Lady for episode six is, for me, the most interesting part. Sometimes we want to hide from ourselves. We do not want to be us. It is too difficult to be us. It is at these times that we turn to drugs or alcohol or behavior to help us forget that we are ourselves. This is, of course, only a temporary solution to a problem which is going to keep returning, and sometimes these temporary solutions are worse for us than the original problem. Yes, it is a dilemma. Is there an answer? Of course there is. As a wise person said with a smile, the answer is within the question. And it hits for me very deeply of sometimes you want, like that intro, the opening, sometimes we want to hide from ourselves. It is too difficult to be us. And yeah, at times, like, I feel like a high schooler could connect with that. I feel like someone who's at varying life stages, you know, like if it's getting married, buying a house, moving, the death of a loved one, a change of job, a change, like, at any point, there are moments where it feels too difficult to be the person you are at that moment. And to sit in that dilemma, is that part of the answer? The one's ability and one's strength to be vulnerable.
Yeah. And that, I think, brings us to episode seven nicely, the idea of the strength it takes to be vulnerable. Yeah. Because Harold Smith lacked that strength. So episode seven, Lonely Souls.
Boom.
Ben is brought in for questioning after Audrey confronts him about One-Eyed Jax and passes the information to Cooper. Andy ponders the meaning of Harold Smith's suicide note. Financial pressures strain Shelley and Bobby's brief happiness. Pete learns Tojimura's plans. Ed's life continues to bewilder as amnesiac Nadine thinks herself a teenager. The Log Lady leads Cooper to the roadhouse in a devastating message. And Laura's killer is finally revealed. Laura's killer is finally revealed.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Like, I think so. I'm this. Yeah. Lonely Souls. There's so much a weight to it. Harold's suicide note, his confession, I am a lonely soul. It feels not like a rejection of the spirit of Twin Peaks, but at least a strike against it. Mm-hmm. We've talked a lot about the connectedness. We've experienced it a lot through Cooper. We've experienced it through characters sharing visions and thoughts and feelings. And so I feel very much a sense of connectedness when I think of Twin Peaks. But Harold, though a resident of Twin Peaks, felt incredibly isolated and felt incredibly alone. And even in a, yes, it's funny how I say it, even in a place like Twin Peaks, Harold dies alone.
And it's tough to know how much of that is of his own volition. The loneliness there.
Yeah.
Why was he a recluse? He walks outside and does the big Nosferatu. Whenever he sees sunlight.
Yeah.
I leaned over to Megan when we were watching that. I said, I don't think David Lynch understands agoraphobia very well.
No. No. That one felt a tad. Even at that point, I was like, Okay. All right.
Yeah.
That a little much.
Yep. Which I guess fits. It's fine. But but why was he a reckless? You know, he clearly cared about other people a great deal. But maybe only one on one. It was more than just being an introvert. It's something different. And maybe it's that tension of he cared about other people so much, but was unable to be vulnerable with them that led to his suicide. That's the kind of idea of the lonely soul. I have no friends. I have no love.
Mm. Yeah, that might be. The two things that I want to talk about are Tojimura and, of course, like the last probably 10 minutes or so of episode seven. But I was completely blindsided by Tojimura. I had no idea. Like, I thought the scene of Pete trying to offer Tojimura a glass of milk was super hilarious. And I was like, oh, well, that's fun. And then Pete alone, I think like making a sandwich or sandwich and bread, sandwich and milk. And he turns and there's Tojimura in the house. And Tojimura just plants one right, just gives him a big kiss. And Jason, I thought Tojimura looked weird. I was like, okay, whatever. But like, as soon, there's not even a thought in my mind of like, no, it's Catherine. She's dressed up as Tojimura, as an out of town investor. And as soon as she kissed him, I was like, oh, Catherine! Catherine, there you are. And I thought it was genius. I about floated. I thought it was amazing.
Oh, it's so good. And the Tojimura character is so racist.
Yes.
And racist that in a weird, really weird way, it turning out that it's Catherine in yellow face, I guess we'd call it. It is almost what makes it okay, because it's not Lynch's racism.
Yeah.
It's not our race. It's Catherine's. This is within her mind. Now, I said almost. Because
almost, yeah,
it's more 1990, okay, I guess. It certainly wouldn't fly now.
No,
but it also says a lot about, you know, why don't we see Tojimura? Why don't we see Catherine? And it's because no one sees Tojimura. It's because we see Tojimura just as a flat, opaque icon, right?
Yeah.
Asian businessman. Boom. And now I know everything I ever need to know. There is no depth to this character whatsoever. I have a stereotype, but that's all I need.
Yeah.
And Catherine uses that to hide. She may even be using our own racism in order to hide. Or maybe I'm giving them too much credit.
Maybe, but I mean, from a twist perspective, I thought it was brilliant. And I'm really glad that Tojimura was a disguise, because it absolutely is racist.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So the last maybe quarter of the episode,
because it's long.
It is long.
This last quarter of it, yeah.
Yeah, and so the log lady leads Cooper and Truman to the roadhouse with a message, and Cooper says, you know, something. It's like, as confirming with the log lady, something is happening though, isn't it? And she nods. And at the same time, Maddie is at the Palmer residence getting ready to leave. And the two locations are intercut together. And not just the two locations, but multiple pockets of people. So you have Bobby at the bar. At the roadhouse, you have James and Donna at a booth at the roadhouse. You have the log lady, Cooper, and Agent Truman at a table. You have the old waiter from the Great Northern, who's there as well. And it seems like a gathering storm of people. And yes, something is happening. That there is this overwhelming sense of something about to occur. in this town. And when there is that revealing of Bob, when there is that turn, and it's vicious, man. Like, it is a nightmare.
Yeah.
In the best sense of the word, and this, like, phantasm that overtakes Leland. And I think it's the first time where we see the changeover really in its full horror. And it is horror. And it reminded me, like, that shared sense of something happening and something occurring. And Cooper has a vision of the giant at the roadhouse. And the giant says, it is happening again. And, you know, like, I see this. I mean, I see it in television later on, but also just, like, I don't know, the moment of, I always associate, for whatever reason, a moment of transcendence with a positive connotation or a moment of, like, shared connectedness.
Mm-hmm.
And this feels like there is that shared moment, but it is very much a tragic thing. Like, Donna begins to weep.
Yeah.
For a reason she can't explain. Bobby seems to, like, come apart internally. Like, I don't know what's... It feels like if Bobby saw the right person, he would start to weep uncontrollably.
Yeah, but he can't.
Yeah.
He won't allow himself to, but yeah.
And he can't do it.
Bobby is so over the top. He's so hammy as an actor.
Yeah. But,
man, he nailed this one scene, which is cry inside. But don't just cry, sob inside. But you're not allowed to sob.
Yeah,
which the only thing I can imagine was the actual direction that Lynch gave him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, fall apart inside, and it really comes across.
Yeah, and I'm convinced there's a connection between the old waiter and the giant.
Mm-hmm. Like, right?
I think just personally, like, I'm not usually one for. I mean, we're doing a show on Twin Peaks, so I think the giant and the waiter are the same person.
There you go.
And just the, like. Just the way that he came over to Cooper after Maddie. Yeah. Elsie's like, I'm so sorry. That devastated me, man.
And he gives the line to Leland in the next episode.
Yeah.
That gum you like.
Yeah. So much. But yeah, in that moment of, on one hand, like, the shared sense of the gathering is very akin to, I don't know if you've seen The Sopranos, but it's very akin to
the finale I've heard about. Yeah.
Yeah. Where life is occurring and there is a sense of something about to happen, like an unnamed dread, an unshaped amorphous feeling. And seeing this episode, it makes very apparent where David Chase got that idea.
Yeah.
It also, real quick, I know we still have episode 8 and 9, but David Milch, who is the writer and creator of Deadwood, did another show shortly after Deadwood called John from Cincinnati. And it lasted one season. It's a real shame because it's sort of like your favorite novelist wrote a really quirky short story, but you love it. And that's John from Cincinnati for me. Like, it takes place in a surf town and this, like, unknown, kind of like this square peg in a round hole guy, John, shows up. And there is a moment in episode, I think 6 or 7 out of 10, where you have all these disparate characters. And it's almost like they, in their own lives, they are on their own paths and they are all charging down darkened corridors. And for one single moment, they all burst through the next door. And for maybe like a second, in that secret miracle, they are all in the same room.
Yeah.
And then they see each other and hear boom, 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 boom. And then just as fast, they're gone. It's as like a perfume, like a scent in the air that's gone. It's like, I think I saw something.
Yeah.
And that's what this moment feels like.
Some of the most sustained analyses of it would be Paul Thomas Anderson's Magnolia. You know, the different lives all connected.
Yeah.
In that, if I remember right, I believe all the lives are connected because they live on the same street, which is Magnolia in L.A. And then, of course, they do all – you discover the other connections between them as the movie goes on.
Oh, I love that movie.
Goodness. Yeah. And then Fargo, the television show. Or the movie. Especially season two. Just these disparate – these kind of things that appear to be coincidences, and yet it's lives aligning so that people can be in the right place at the right time for meaning to happen. Okay, one other thing I want to talk about is when Leland switches over to Bob.
Yeah.
There's something about the way it's shot that is both hokey, cheesy, feels like poorly done special effects. And it's like over the top, there'll be like strobe light effects and things like that. And one face just plastered on top of the other, you know, double exposure.
Yeah.
And also is so incredibly effective. And not at all cheesy and completely serious. And I was curious if you felt the same way about that, if it hits you the same way. Because to me, this is pure Lynch, that way of using something, an effect that looks cheesy, that looks – that usually is seen as ham-fisted, and then all of a sudden it making it have meaning and interest and making it really foreboding.
Yeah, it almost feels like if someone's playing Moonlight Sonata on the piano and then just elbows the bottom – like the last octave,
yeah,
and not just elbows it once, but like elbows it, leans on the sustain pedal for about 15 seconds, and then does it again for 15 seconds, and then does it again, and like
just in case you thought it was an accident,
yeah, just
make it real clear,
it's like this one's on purpose,
yeah.
I think his name is Cage, but
yeah, John Cage,
4 minutes and 33 seconds,
yep.
Where he sits down on the piano and plays nothing for four minutes and 33 seconds.
Yep.
For me, it was totally unsettling because there is sadly a standard way of shooting an attack, of manufacturing a rhythm.
Yeah.
And it is it's a nauseous feeling. Like, it's blurry, it's crass, it's just, it's ugly. And perhaps that is something, maybe part of why it stands out. Like, it's just ugly. Like,
yeah,
there's
it's ugly. It goes way too long.
Oh, yeah.
Way too long.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is actually, I think, good.
Yeah, it's not well shot by, like, the normal definition.
Right. Camera spinning wildly.
Yeah. And it's, in that sense, it's just like greasy and like,
yeah,
just off. But it is terrifying. Like, honestly, it was one of the most like terrifying scenes so far.
Yeah. And it's intercut with the giant. And it's these two sides of David Lynch. Just in the way that the giant is being shot on stage. You talked about Bob attacking Maddie as greasy, as poorly shot. You know, it doesn't feel right. Everything feels off. Mm. When the giant fades out and we get the band again, they had the entire crowd sit still in the exact pose that they would be in. And then as one, they move back into movement.
Yeah.
And there's, so far as I can tell with Lynch at that time period, there was no technological trickery. It was just a double exposure, right? You're just crossfading one onto the other, which means you physically have people standing in the exact position that they will be at, and you have them all resume movement at the exact same moment. It's as simple as that.
Yep.
And it's so incredibly effective.
Yeah.
And he nails it. Nobody coughs. Nobody moves at the wrong moment. I mean, it's really impressive.
Yeah. And so much in the unspoken, the shared exchange between the giant and Cooper. Of it almost, I mean, it felt very 2001 of Dave Bowman, the astronaut, communicating or not communicating or trying to sense and discern what Hal is thinking or what Hal is going to do next.
Right.
Just that, like, the center frame back and forth between Cooper and the giant felt like a very clear callback
to
Kubrick.
All right. Let's move on to episode 8 then. And this is another one I'm pretty okay with getting through quickly. A lot happens, yeah. But it's a lot of action. We'll kind of cover it with the summary. And episode 9, we can linger. Yep. So episode 8, Drive with a Dead Girl. Jerry tries to arrange a defense for Ben, who's in jail for Laura's murder. By the way, just a great line. Jerry to Ben, as your legal counsel, let me recommend to you that you get a better lawyer. Cooper is skeptical of Ben committing the crime, which Truman contradicts. Later, Pete visits Ben with an audio message from Catherine in a delightful scene, if I do say so myself, who is willing to back up his alibi on terms that he surrenders all of his property. Meanwhile, the real killer, Leland, under possession by Bob, stuffs the dead Maddie Ferguson in his golf bag, leaving more evidence to implicate Ben. Elsewhere, Norma's estranged mother, Vivian Smythe, arrives for a visit with her new husband, while Hank reappears after several days. Lucy arrives back in Twin Peaks with her older sister, Gwen, where Lucy is approached by Andy, who wants to get back together with her. Later, the one-armed man escapes from police custody, warning them that Bob is nearby.
Yeah, so this episode felt like the parade of characters I could care less about.
Right.
Of, like, Norma's mom, Lucy's sister, and... Yeah, that's about it. But just, yeah, a lot of, like, who are these people? I don't care. Right. Like, moving it. Here are the things that I got out of this episode. Leland, under possession by Bob, is incredibly strong. If he can stuff Maddie Ferguson in a golf bag and with one arm, over one shoulder, carry her out. Bob is a demon, but he is a strong one. So
a strong demon.
Favorite line from Ben, in reference to the one-armed man. This man's stairs do not reach all the way to the attic.
No, they do not.
And the one, like, maybe trying to make a mountain out of a molehill thing this episode for me, when Vivian's new husband and Hank are talking, apparently they have some shared time in prison. I think his nickname is the Professor.
Yep.
You have the Professor wanting to lead a clean life now. Was a con man, now trying to change over, and almost as a throwaway, he says, "I'm trying very hard to tell nothing but the truth these days." And I think just because it's Twin Peaks, anytime someone mentions the truth or lies or like anytime someone calls that stuff out, it feels like it has little extra resonance for me or a little extra season.
Yeah,
I mean, truthfully, that's it. Aside from the one-armed man escaping custody and really kind of tightening the screws on, the discovery of Maddie Ferguson at the end of the episode is a clear callback to the pilot.
Yeah.
And it's going to throw us right into episode 9.
Yeah. And that callback to the pilot is something that should alert you that, in a sense, Twin Peaks is ending.
Yeah.
David Lynch resisted ever revealing who the killer was.
Really?
That was important to him. Yep. He wanted to never do that.
Oh, wow.
And the network definitely wanted, they wanted the killer at the end of season one. And maybe a new killer each season, you know, something like that. They wanted something very formulaic. He wanted it to never happen.
Wow. And
I think some of the lines at the end of episode 9 tell you why, which is that he wants this sense of ambivalence and ambiguity. And he's able to retain that with the plot device of having Leland be the killer and also not be the killer.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to ask you, at what point did you realize that Leland killed Laura? And I asked this because I was watching with Megan and she was still trying to, I think, convince herself that Leland didn't, this demon possessed Leland. But it had previously possessed someone else. She was able to do that during episode 7. Episode 8, it got a little bit more tenuous. And by episode 9, you can't do that anymore. You know, it's all admitted. It's all out in the open.
Yeah.
But she wanted so badly not to believe that Leland had done that it had to be blocked out.
Mm-hmm. I had, for whatever reason, I had no trouble.
Yeah.
I guess, like, when I saw the possession, when I saw the changeover, I had assumed that it was Bob. That Leland had been working under Bob's influence and had killed Laura.
Yep. Yeah. And you called Leland at the end of the first season. I don't know if you recall it, but if you listen back to what exactly am I watching here, you can listen to yourself predict that.
Really?
Yeah. You said, I said, who do you think the killer is? And you said, well, I mean, the easy answer is one of the parents. Who's closest to the victim.
But I feel like it's like a half credit correct answer. I'm just like, well, it's Leon Palmer, but actually under the possession of a spirit named Bob, who's representation of evil of all mankind.
Yes.
If I had said something akin to that.
Yeah. Well, then I'd give it to you.
Yeah.
All right. So on to episode 9, Arbitrary Law. From a piece of Laura's secret diary, Cooper discovers that he and Laura shared the same dream. Catherine tricks Ben into signing away the mill. Andy and Tremaine, the potential fathers of Lucy's baby, confront each other. James leaves town, and Laura's killer is unmasked. Mm. So I think the Cooper and Laura having the same dream is just one of the coolest little moments in the show. Like, in some senses, it doesn't matter. It doesn't, you know, propel the plot in any ways. But her describing the same dream, and yet it's from her point of view, is such a cool scene.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. This episode is dynamite. It might be my favorite episode of Twin Peaks so far. And for so many reasons, the shared dream, it's different than how Cooper described the dream. And it felt like a very, since it felt like when Laura was writing this diary, like it comes from a very sincere place. And I mean, it feels like a diary entry. It feels like this confession to something or someone, and something very tender and very hopeful in the midst of something very dark. She knows that there is this spirit, that there is this evil. And in the dream, in this place, she was able to be without secrets. She was able to call evil for what it was. And that must have been very freeing for her.
Yeah. I think, I'm not sure if this section of the diary was written by Jennifer Lynch, David Lynch's daughter.
Mm.
But The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer did come out, I believe, at the beginning of season 2. And it was a book you could actually buy and read. And it was written by Jennifer Lynch, who was 22 at the time. So not quite in high school, but kind of in touch with her high school self and could write it in that voice.
Yeah.
And so it does carry a very different voice than the rest of the series. I would like to think that she wrote the dream section as well.
Another scene that struck me outside of, again, the kind of like the last half of the episode was James and Donna, where Donna discovers, she puts the pieces together that Maddie is dead, and she tells James, who at the beginning of the episode proposes to Donna, seemingly proposes to Donna,
right,
and is on cloud nine. And when he finds out that Maddie is dead, he calls it out, like, our happiness doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because the world is always going to be set against us. And that honestly felt like, maybe this is getting ahead of myself, but I'm kind of concerned as to like where Twin Peaks goes from here, because that honestly felt like, oh, that's the end of James.
Yeah.
Like, James is just going to write off and be gone. And I'm okay with it. Like, that's where James lands, of like, my happiness is ephemeral and in the grand scheme of things is pointless. No matter what I try to do, there's going to be death, there's going to be sadness, there's going to be brokenness everywhere I go.
Yeah. We live in an evil world, and evil is all around us. And for James, that moment of the proposal was a forgetting of that fact. He could only propose because he could forget that there is evil in the world.
Mm-hmm.
He could only love because he could forget the evil. This is back to Harold Smith's vulnerability, right?
Yeah.
And I think Donna is more okay with living in an evil world and finding love there, because that's the only world we have. And maybe that makes it even more important to find meaning, because the meaning won't find you. You've got to create it.
Man, so much in this in this episode. Even just like Cooper coming to trust himself, hearing it initially from Hawk, when Hawk tells him, "You're on the path. You don't need to know where it leads." And Rosenfield giving him encouragement and like, "You go wherever it is you have to go. Like, you are the one equipped to walk this road."
If I could read that line real quick, because I do have it up.
Oh yeah, please.
"Cooper, an observation. I don't know where this is headed, but the only one of us with the coordinates for this destination and its hardware is you. Go on whatever vision quest you require. Stand on the rim of a volcano, stand alone, and do your dance. Just find this beast before he takes another bite." I love that line. I love that.
Yeah.
Good dialogue.
I think it's gorgeous stuff.
Yeah.
And yeah, and continuing bedside with the one-armed man, Cooper knowing, almost confounded by the riddle of the answer is inside.
Yeah.
And just step by step, trusting. And like returning to the roadhouse, I thought it was a beautiful, beautiful stroke of storytelling. And the gathering of people, I thought was a wonderful element. I smiled, man, when Cooper says someone is missing and Major Briggs shows up with, and I keep calling him an old waiter, but it's, he has a name.
No, his name is the old bellhop.
That's the old bellhop. Okay. And the old bellhop, it just feels, I mean, like kismet, fate, it feels meant. It feels on purpose. It is the surprise that was bound to happen. And like you look back and like, well, of course it had to happen this way.
Yeah.
But in the moment, it's a surprise and it's a delight. And he's the kind of key when he offers the gum and he says that gum you like is going to come back in style. One of my many smiles in this episode. And that's when that's just like, that's when it all connects. And when we hear what Laura whispered for the first time.
Yeah.
And then like a terrific fake out.
Yeah. Right.
Like when I was a little pissed. I was like, wait, what? Like you heard it. It's the dream. Yeah. And then he's like, gives the thumbs up. I'm like, don't give me that thumbs up, man. Like, come on. Yeah, whatever that business is. And then they go back to the station and there's like that terrific, terrific fake out. Because that's the only way you're gonna capture Bob. And this is
what you're always cheering for. Mm. When the cops finally get the killer at the end of the show, they always let him slip away.
Mm.
Right? Yeah. And this one, they did it perfectly. You're like, no, don't let him know you're onto him. No. You can't just take him into the cell. You need to throw him in there and lock the door. Yeah. If you're going to interrogate him, you need to chain him down and point a gun to him the entire time you interrogated him. He's too evil. Yeah. And they do all of those things. It's great. It's like they know all the tropes they're supposed to fall into. And they're just like, no, I'm not going to do that. Yeah. He's not getting away. We got this.
Yeah. But, and here's though, like, I think where Lynch is really, really firing is that in some senses, it's a hollow Pyrrhic victory.
Yeah.
It's an incomplete victory because what we are left with is a man who is coming to the devastating realization that he killed his daughter and killed his niece and had no choice in the matter, was taken over, was as a boy taken over and lied to by this evil. And like it echoes if the Log Lady VO was part of a book, I'd buy it.
Right.
But so she says, so now the sadness comes, the revelation. There is a depression after an answer is given. It was almost fun not knowing. Yes, now we know. At least we know what we sought in the beginning. But there is still the question, why? And this question will go on and on until the final answer comes. Then the knowing is so full, there is no room for questions. And there is a sadness in this revelation, because they see Bob in his terror, in his feralness. And the fact that Bob leaves and is gone at this point, like, that's a terrifying truth. You know, like, we are left still with our, almost like what the judge in earlier in season two, just like, we are left with our laws and our little dances and our things. And for a time, like, this is all we have. And this evil is out there still. Like, it's been momentarily thwarted, but it has not at all been stopped or solved.
Yeah, and the final line of the episode is, if he was real, this is Sheriff Truman, if he was real, if he was here, we had him trapped and he got away. Where's Bob now?
Yeah. And so we started this podcast 5 minutes after I'd finished episode 9. And Sheriff Truman says, where's Bob? And there's that great Evil Dead, you know, first person,
right?
Little run and gun. I'm like, Sam Raimi. And so we just run moon through the forest. And all there's a light. And I out loud, holy fuck, the owls.
They are not what they seem, bro.
No, they're not. Those lion sons of bitches. Oh, gosh.
This has been the recurring joke in my household now. Somebody says something about owls, and I'll say, hey, Megan, those owls, any idea if they are what they seem, or how you feel about, oh no, Jason, they're not what they seem. Oh, good to know. And it continued into last night I was putting my two-year-old down, and she wanted her owl pajamas. And I put them on, and I said, okay, be careful, Maddie, because, you know, these owls, they're not what they seem. Ooh. And I just heard this laugh from downstairs, because evidently Megan could hear me in the monitor. It was so great. And from that touching moment to some more disturbing ones. But first, one more kind of interesting thing. I don't know how comedic it is. I've got the script for Twin Peaks season 2 episode 9 in front of me.
You do?
And I can send you this website that has all the scripts if you'd like to look at them. These are the uncorrected scripts, and I didn't know what that meant until I was reading this one, like what would be different.
Mm-hmm.
There's a really interesting difference that I just noticed.
Okay.
And it's that all of Leland's lines are given to Ben in that final scene, meaning that in-house, they still didn't want people to know that Leland was the murderer.
Wow.
There's still some of the lines they didn't fix. So Cooper calls him Ben instead of Leland in all the lines as it's written. That'd be an easy thing to fix on set, right?
Yeah.
The one thing they didn't catch is during that scene with the four of them at the end, there is a reference to his own daughter. Okay. And in fact, let's go to that and let's get real sad for a second. So this is Albert Cooper, Major Briggs, and Sheriff Truman all together trying to figure out what happened.
Mm.
And Truman starts saying he was insane. He was schizophrenic like Gerard.
Yeah.
Coop says, was he? Well, what's the alternative? Ghosts and goblins? Albert says, an elemental spirit. Briggs offers the gentleman, there is more in heaven and earth than is dreamt of in our philosophy. But Albert says, but people saw him. You know, Albert's the logical one. People saw Bob, Laura, Maddie, Sarah Palmer. They all saw him. And Sheriff Truman, how did Ronette see him in the train car? Coop says, maybe the head injury. The trauma opened some kind of perpetual window. You're right. This is the Agent Mulder, Agent Scully thing going back and forth. Was it real? Was it not?
Yeah.
Truman, I've lived in these woods all my life. I've heard some strange things, seen some too, but this is way off the map. I'm having a hard time believing. And this is the line for me. This is Coop.
Mm.
Is it easier to believe a man would rape and murder his own daughter? Is that any more comforting? And there's something about Twin Peaks. It's so fanciful. It's so surreal. And it's so it's not believable, right? the idea that this demon would inhabit Leland. But the events that it describes do happen in the real world.
Yeah.
And our explanation for them is no better, no more believable, in the sense that I cannot fathom that. That cannot be true. So it is an investigation into what could evil be. And then do you feel better if you define it the way you had it before?
Mm.
Yeah.
Even Rosenfield's, maybe Bob is just the evil that men do. It feels remarkably pat and feels like that is no more comforting. Cause that's what I'm looking for.
Yep.
And that's what we are looking for. Like, I want an answer that fits. I want law and order. I want my 42 minutes of a problem and a solution and everyone goes to bed. And the fact that life will not conform to that. And should we pretend that it does or ought to? Like, well, you can. Like, you can try and do that. But it will break you. And you will be confronted with your hypocrisy in some way, some form or some fashion at some point down the road. It's going to be a reckoning. And the scene in the interrogation room, just Leland outpouring, the moment between Cooper and Leland, I think, Jason, just, you've been studying Zen for a year, you said, a little over a year.
Yeah.
I mean, this felt like the series finale, if I'm honest. And this just felt like, at this point, I could walk away and just be like, wow, what an incredible show. But maybe, Jason, if you could go ahead and read Cooper's.
Yeah, I've got it pulled up. The moment that and it does say Ben and not Leland, which is even better. Yeah. Because again, they clearly were trying to cover it. Before that, though, you said this is the moment you could end. I've heard it said that the difference between comedy and tragedy is where you stop the movie.
Hmm.
Any comedy becomes tragic if you keep the movie going too long.
Yeah.
And any tragedy, there's going to be happy moments. Mm-hmm. Right? If you keep on filming, it's going to come back around. That's the way that life works.
Yeah.
If you want a satisfying ending to Twin Peaks, you can stop watching now. This is as good as it's going to get.
Mm.
There will be other moments where you can stop, but you're not going to want to stop at the end of season two when they set up cliffhangers for a season three that never occurred, that they didn't know wasn't happening. That's a little bit of a spoiler, but it's 25 years old. You know that they didn't get picked up for season three.
Yeah.
And you know that they were probably going to lay some cliffhangers like they did earlier. Mm-hmm. So let me get back to then what he says to Leland. Leland, the time has come for you to seek the path. Your soul has set you face to face before the clear light. And now you're about to experience it in its reality, wherein all things are like the void and cloudless sky, and the naked, spotless intellect is like a transparent vacuum, without circumference or center. At this moment, know yourself and abide in that state. Look toward the light, Leland. Look toward the light. That is actually picking up a lot of Zen things. Specifically, the term cloudless sky is a Zen idea. That's the perceiving of reality so pure it's as though there's no cloud in the sky whatsoever.
Mm.
There's a very famous Zen patriarch who was handing off his monkly duties to the next Zen patriarch, and he had to choose who it was going to be. And one wrote a poem about a sky that was so clear there was not a cloud in it. And the next had a mirror set up. And he cleaned the mirror perfectly so that there was not a spot on it, so it would reflect the sky perfectly. And there was no imperfection. And the third, who wasn't a monk, he was basically just an itinerant, the janitor. He'd been there the least amount of time.
Yeah.
He walks up and pantomimes polishing the mirror. And of course, he's chosen as the next patriarch. And he's a major figure in Zen philosophy. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that you can't get a mirror clean enough.
Mm-hmm.
To be perception, to be that pure experience of the world. Mm-hmm. As long as you're using a mirror, it's not pure. You know, you're still too far from it. And so this is for Agent Cooper, someone who I'm guessing has practiced some meditation and these kinds of things, realizes that on this side of death, there is no cloudless sky. There is no pure mirror. There is no pure experience.
Yeah.
And there's him guiding Leland forward, but also, I think, a little bit jealous. You're going to experience the undiscovered country, the thing that I know nothing about, what I've studied so much. Go there. Be there. And don't miss this moment.
Yeah.
Because you only get it once.
Yeah. It felt very gentle. Like, on one hand, you have sort of like a comic version of the gun on the mantle, with the water, and yet it also becomes a very tragic and heartfelt scene. And Cooper very lovingly, like grace, showing grace to someone isn't always a painless experience. And the grace that Cooper shows Leland of guiding him to face his true self, that's going to hurt.
Yeah.
But it is one of the most loving things that can be done at that moment. And as much as duplicity plays a part in Twin Peaks, I think because of that, when there are moments of unadulterated clarity, when there is that light, that just like straight beam, man, is it powerful. Like I know I felt it 100%. And that's just, for me, it made for a beautiful piece of storytelling.
It's such an apex to the story. And mm-hmm. It signals itself as such and says, you know, I'm going to direct the shit out of this scene.
Yeah.
So sit back and enjoy. Cool. Well, where do we go from there? Anything else about episode 9 or ready to close this out?
I'm ready to shut the book on episode 9. And like I said earlier, the main things for me going forward, I'm nervous.
Yeah.
Because I thought, this feels like just a home run across the board. It feels like, if not a perfect resolution, all of our characters have arrived at a place. And that really is the most I can ask for, it feels like. And going from here, if the story is going to continue on, am I interested? Absolutely. Like there are characters I care about. And if you're telling me that you're going to keep telling stories about these characters in this world, I'll watch. Absolutely. But I am apprehensive.
Yeah. This is where the show loses people.
Okay.
It's right here. As soon as you find out who killed Laura Palmer, there's a reason that Lynch didn't want to show it.
Yeah.
Right. He knew that he would lose people.
Yeah.
But on the flip side of that, if the reason he didn't want to show it was because he cared more about the characters and he just wanted to continue telling stories, well, that's what you're going to get from now on. There will be new mysteries. They're already getting set up, right?
Yeah.
You know, episode, I think it was 6, where we said, you know, there's a lot of things happening, but the plot doesn't really move anywhere. Well, it's all setting up episodes 10, 11, 12, 13, and so on.
Yeah.
Right? Wyndham Earl, will he be part of it? Yeah, probably. I mean, seems to be setting him up as the big bad, whatever that is.
Yeah, I sure hope so.
In the reverse, right? Whereas season 1 was all about there's a murder and we got to figure out who did it. Now it's Wyndham Earl is coming. What's he going to do?
Yeah.
What's going to happen? But yeah, we know who it is. We just don't know the what.
Yeah. Like there's been a lot of fake outs of arrivals. Mm-hmm. I guess that's maybe even something that I'm noticing in season 2. Like a lot of people are coming to Twin Peaks in season 2. And a lot of people are supposed to come to Twin Peaks. Like M.T. Wentz, like this, again, this force, this food critic. And then you have Mr. Tajimura, who is, again, like an unknown entity coming in, and Wyndham Earl hangs over all of this as at some point, somewhere, he's going to show up. So there is there is still that dread, and there is still that foreboding. Something is bound to happen.
Yep. Excited to watch those along with you.
Yeah.
Episodes 10 through 13 coming up next.
Perfect.
All right. Thanks again for joining us on What Exactly Am I Watching Here? For next time, we'll be working through season 2, episodes 10 through 13. So off you go with the Bookhouse Boys. You can get a hold of us on Twitter, where our handle is @OverthinkPod, and find more at OverthinkPod.com. For now, just a quick reminder, you're on the path. You don't need to know where it leads. Just follow.
That's impossible, Jason.
Yes, it is.